Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City. Today, no guest. I wanted to have an opportunity to share more commentaries and insightful, socially based issues, lots on health. We're going to talk about why so many Americans are diabetic. In fact, 40% of all Americans are going to be diabetic in their lifetime, and we have millions, tens of millions, between pre-diabetic and diabetic, about one-third of the American population. Also, for all the women who had double mastectomies to save their lives, we've been opposed to that. Now, new research out of Stanford University says we were right, and unfortunately a lot of mutilation and sacrifice of women's breasts for the wrong cause. We're also going to look at an hour of exercise a day does a lot for your heart and a lot more on health and healing. Then from our environmental segment, Sweden is recycling 99% of garbage, edging closer to a zero waste. That would be the best in the world. So there is a revolution going on in Sweden right now. They're calling it the Recycling Revolution. And the Scandinavian country now recycles 99% of their garbage. So what can we learn about this? Well, we have a lot to learn on other issues. And one of the issues I'm taking on today is brand new research that you have not read anywhere, but it's quality research. And I'm surprised that we have not heard commentaries on it. It comes from the Social Science Review, which is a major journal. It was done by University of Michigan and Harvard University, and it shows that 4.3% of Americans survive on how much per day? How much do you think? What would it take to survive? You know, meaning pay for your lodging, eat food, take care of the basic necessities. If you know how much that is, call us at 888-874-4888. I'll answer that a little later in the program. Also, I spoke with one of the whistleblowers today. We will be arranging for an original press conference as soon as the attorneys and the whistleblower attorneys say it's okay, hopefully next week, to tell you the truth of what's been going on in the vaccine field. But I will read you today something that you have not been aware of. The email between Dr. Andrew Wakefield and Dr. Thompson, the whistleblower at the CDC, who was a part of covering up the MMR, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, causing autism in a high percentage of African-American children. So we'll deal with that, and I'll quote you the actual emails. They're very revealing. From Ralph Nader today from Counterpunch, the crime of overbilling. It's huge. I mean, it is so huge that we could end poverty in the United States if we just applied in 1 year what is fraudulently overbilled in 1 year. That's how big it is, and I'll go into depth on that. We are retiring in droves. How many people do you think are retiring each day in the United States? If you know how many people are retiring each day, every 24 hours, call us at 888-874-4888. Otherwise, I'll tell you a little later on and why. And then the U.S. government can brand you as a terrorist based upon a Facebook post. I'm not making it up. I'll give you the facts. Also, why doctors are sick of their profession. From Sandeep Jabhur of the Wall Street Journal. American physicians are increasingly unhappy with their once very positively perceived profession. And this malaise is bad for their patients. It's really bad. I'll share that with you. So as you see, we have a lot to cover, and some people are traveling. Not to worry. Anywhere in the United States and Canada that you are away from a let's say, an internet connection or a land-based station, you can always listen by just dialing a phone number. That number is 712-432-7231, and you can listen to the show, 712-432-7231. And Aubrey, our social media coordinator here, said that the average age of the people listening, 60%, were between the ages of 16 and 34 years of age. We appreciate that many young people tuning in and sharing the information. Thank you. Close to 40% of the adult population in the United States will have diabetes at some point in their lifetime. We have a lot. This, according to the Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology report, and the team of U.S. researchers combined data from nationally representative populations interviewed and death certificates for over 600,000 adults, and that's where they came up with these figures. And it's getting worse, and there is nothing we're doing nationally to reverse it. And obesity is getting worse as well. Why? I believe it's not one single factor. I believe from my own counseling of tens of thousands of people that it's multifactorial. But high up on the list would be younger people are conditioned to eat unhealthy food. You do not see advertisements on television promoting eating healthy vegetables, organic fruits, non-GMO crops, locally grown, drinking healthy juices. As a result, you see colas. Go into a movie theater. I saw a really good movie, and on Boyhood, it was very original in how it was filmed. They actually filmed a young boy through about, I'm guessing, about 13 years of his life, and they actually took that long to film it, filming a little bit each year. So you see in all these transitions, wonderful film to see. And then you see at the beginning of the film a commercial. And every movie theater, major movieplex in the United States has commercials, almost always for Coca-Cola or some other soft drink. You never see them for a healthy product. So that's where the kids get their information, what they should be eating and drinking, and what snacks they should have, what sugared cereal they should have. And they identify with these, unless the parent explains why these are not healthy and offers some healthier option that is also tasty and explains it in a way that the child feels they're not being punished, but rather rewarded by having something that's healthy. And there are parents doing that, by the way. In fact, I interviewed some children for a new film that I've finished. It's done. We'll be released in the next probably 9 months or so. And there's very conscientious parents, and they brown bag their kids' food. Now the kids have to take 4 or 5 extra helpings because their food is the food that is healthy and organic, gluten-free and wheat-free and dairy-free, that is desired by the friends of the children when they go to school. And the parents say that they provide all kinds of fun things that are tasty. So there are parents, but the vast majority are not doing that. The kids are eating garbage in school, and we all know that. Hospitals, garbage. It's vendor food. And don't be fooled by them saying, well, we have a nutritionist, yeah? You mean you have a registered dietitian who is clueless about anything involving health? I should know. I am a registered dietitian. And I know the difference between a holistic dietitian who, in effect, just discards all the garbage information they learned in dietetic schools and goes on to learn what quality information is out there on real healing and prevention. In any case, we are diabetic also because because we're very stressed. And when people are stressed, they eat comfort foods. And also, if they're eating under anxiety, as many people are, you turn off the appetite mechanism, meaning you eat a dinner, and a half hour later, you're back in the fridge, but your stomach is full. You're sitting in front of a television, and you just can't help it. You just keep eating the chips or the chocolate or something. You just keep putting it in. Well, the body can't handle that, doesn't need it. It's just water overflowing in a glass, except this water is glucose, fructose, high fructose corn syrup. And it's devastating your pancreas, your beta cells, the islet of Langerhans, and is causing metabolic syndrome. It's leading you to have heart disease, cancer, arthritis, and diabetes. And also, we have forgotten what it is to eat a reasonable amount of food. We eat too much. Our portion sizes are too large. You should always get up from a meal when you could still eat more. And you should never eat everything on your plate if you're the average American. Then you're overeating. Caloric restriction is one of the hallmarks of living a longer life. I remember the first time I thought about doing a study. And what motivated me to do this study was a fellow I had met when I was 18 years old who worked out in our gym. And it was a little homemade gym. It was in a guy's garage. There was no YMCA. So we would lift weights. And I was a weightlifter at that time. And this very thin guy came in. I mean, I was the smallest guy in my group, and I was 237 pounds, all muscle. There's some photographs set up on my website. And the biggest guy was almost 300 pounds, Big Jim Brock. And this guy, I don't think he weighed 135 pounds. Yet he did things none of us could do. And he talked about what he ate, and we thought, you know, that's too little food. So later, when I was at the Institute of Pi Biology, I just decided, what would happen if I restricted the calories, total calories, so that there was some partial fasting? And I also called a man who I had a lot of respect for, who lived in California. Bernard Jensen was his name. He's passed, I guess, 15 years ago or so. And he was one of the nicest, most affable people I've ever met. Had a beautiful place out in California. I visited when I was on tour. And just looking over the rolling hills and seeing the fruit trees and saw how he ate. And he said to me that the people who lived the longest life in the world were the Hunza Cuts. And the Hunza lived up in the mountains, the Tibetan mountains, at anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 feet. And they fasted a lot, he said, because the winters can be harsh, and therefore you don't really have a lot of fresh food until the spring, until the first fruits come in. And then in the summer and the fall, it's fine. So they learn how to not overeat. And he said, and they live long, long lives. Well, I would meet the mirror of Hunza and his sons. And that was when China wanted to put a road through Hunza, which would impact their 70,000 residents there, into India. In any case, they were the basis of Hilton's novel Lost Horizon with Ronald Coleman. I think Myrna Loy was in it. Back in the 1930s, where an aircraft crashes and they find this Shangri-La, where people live long lives. Well, there really was a Hunza, and it was founded by people who deserted Alexander the Great's crusade when he was in India, and they knew they had to escape and get completely away, or they'd have been killed as deserters. And that's why their features were unique. Some would have blonde hair and blue eyes, different than the typical Asian look in that area, but they lived long lives. And I was told by and shown photographs at the time of people playing kind of like a horse polo in Hunza, and they were over 90 years of age. And mind you, they didn't have photoshopping back then, so I'm looking at these old photographs, and I'm assuming they were real. But then the sun said, and the mirror said, the ruler finds it, yeah. We have people in their hundreds. Okay. So then I decided, let's just see. And I gave a group of rats less food, but the food was extremely nourishing. And they lived over 20% longer than the other group that received the normal portions. And then I tried it with humans, and I found that it was extremely invigorating, increasing energy, and helping overcome a lot of problems, including constipation, bloating, gas, distension, fatigue, muscle aches and pains. And then that's where I began the genesis of a dietary changes, and I worked at it and changed it, did over 100 experiments, and each one building upon the previous one to what, and that's what I advocate now, eating less food, less calories, more nutrient-rich, but caloric-dense. Get rid of the caloric-dense. That's where you get your deep-fried foods, loaded with fat and loaded with calories. And remember, you're getting twice the number of calories per gram when you consume fat and alcohol as you do when you consume protein or carbohydrate. 4 versus 8. So it doesn't take a lot of a French fry, potato chip, pizza, onion rings, ice cream, in order to pack on the extra weight. So that's another reason that we're a diabetic nation. Now, for the mastectomy issue, this is from Stanford University School of Medicine. Let me quote it verbatim. Quote, having a double mastectomy for early stage breast cancer is not linked to a lower risk of death than breast conserving therapy plus radiation, but still there's an increase in the number of women undergoing the procedure. This was published in the current issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. And this is not the first study I might mention to question the benefits of double mastectomy or bilateral mastectomy, the removal of both breasts, for breast cancer patients. Earlier this year, I reported on this program that Medical News Today reported on a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Surgery, claiming the procedure was unnecessary, I repeat, unnecessary, for the vast majority of women. And the researchers of this latest study included Dr. Allison Curran of the Stanford University School of Medicine. And, quote, because bilateral mastectomy is an elective procedure for unilateral breast cancer and cancer in one breast and may have detrimental effects in terms of complications and associated costs as well as body image and sexual function, a better understanding of its use now comes as crucial to improving cancer care. So think of all the hundreds of thousands of women who have had double mastectomy, and they didn't have to. So that's one of those stories where I'm sorry to say I was right, but after writing over 30 articles on it and doing a book on it and a documentary, we've warned women, don't have healthy breasts removed because you're told you have the gene, like Angelina Jolie. That was one of the most foolish things a person could do, because A, you just mutilated yourself at the altar of medical hubris and arrogance. There was no benefit to you. Now I'm saying it again for double mastectomies. And also, instead of the typical way of trying to determine do you have tumors in the breast, mammography, try thermography. Thermography has no radiation. It's based upon measuring heat differentiation. And Dr. Lamb showed us years ago that when cancer is present, even if there's no signs, even if there's no way of palpating the tissue and finding it or seeing it, the heat differentiation will tell you that you've got a problem. And that could save people from developing cancer because of the procedure. Good news, if you exercise. This is a new study published in the journal Circulation, and it says the following from Medical News Today. It may be a no-brainer that exercise is good for your heart, but a new study conducted by Swedish researchers has found that as little as 1 hour of moderate exercise or 30 minutes of vigorous exercise a day could be enough to reduce your risk of heart failure by 46%. Wow. Brisk walking, dancing, gardening, housework, active involvement in games and sports, any of those would qualify. And if you don't think that's important, remember, heart failure happens to 5.1 million people in the United States, and that is serious. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest in health and healing. Now from our environmental segment. As I mentioned at the top of the program, Sweden is recycling 99% of the garbage. This is the latest from Sweden. Quote, wouldn't it be great if no household waste was wasted? If each and every item of refuse was turned into something else, new products, raw materials, gas, or at least heat. Sweden is almost there. More than 99% of all household waste is recycled in one way or another. This means that the country has done a great job at recycling. It's a revolution. It's lasted decades. And considering that it was only 38% of household waste they could recycle in 1975, today it's 99%. Sweden already imports roughly 800,000 tons of garbage per year from the UK, Italy, and Norway and Ireland to generate electricity and heating for the country's 32 waste-to-energy power plants. How about that? Today, recycling stations are no more than 300 meters from any residential area in Sweden, so anyone can make a drop-off. So, all right, we should be doing that in the United States. Waste less, use the waste for powering stations. That's terrific. Good for you, Sweden, for doing that. Last time I was in Sweden, I visited a man named Eric Honecker, who's like the Ralph Nader of Sweden. And it was interesting. I was looking at the smallest strawberries I'd ever seen. They were sweet as can be. He told me they have a very short growing season there, so therefore things are more dense in their sweetness, but smaller in their size. Now to a different area, but still on health, but this is a larger issue. This is from Ralph Nader from Counterpunch, an article entitled The Crime of Overbilling Healthcare. And I will quote it, but then I'll also, it's posted on our site. And just a moment on the postings. I believe last week we had, and I'm going to ask my engineer to verify this with Aubrey, I believe I saw the figure and it was like 7 million, about around 7 million postings or people viewing our web, on the site. And what I do is we post hard-hitting articles, real in-depth articles from progressive minds around the world. But then I go on early in the morning, about 4 o'clock, and I post things that I believe people should start today with, things that are inspirational, things that make you feel good, things that make you smile and laugh, and quotes from great quotes. I love great quotes. I've always been inspired by great quotes. And then something dealing with animals. We all love animals, or should. And to show you how unique animals are in their behavior, I always like to show you something. Today it was a baby elephant playing with a ribbon. It's just adorable to watch. And then how animals get along together. The unusual pairings, like an orangutan being the best friend of a dog, where they go swimming together and they play together. And then when they take a nap, the dog puts its head down in the lap of the orangutan, and the orangutan pets it, and the dog goes to sleep. Just beautiful things like that. I believe we need more of that in our lives. I believe that we need to be inspired by the spiritual and the humane. And so I select anywhere from 30 to 100 of those a day and put up. And then also where there's police brutality that is not in the news, that we have to know about this, because I'm absolutely convinced, I've written articles on it, I've done programs on it, that we've become a police state. That is not a condemnation of all police. In fact, any time I find when the police have done something, a police officer has done something unique and wonderful, I put it up. I want people to see. I want them to see what's going on, but I also want them to see that there are those who care. And I believe at some point, it will be those police officers or those people in the military standing up for the Constitution and our Bill of Rights and saying, no, we can't do this. Because now they're arresting people for the simplest of issues. Just five police officers went into a woman's home because her grass was too high. The reason her grass hadn't been cut is because she had cancer and couldn't do it. But they were ready to, you know, there to arrest her. Five police officers to arrest a woman because her lawn grass was too high. What have we become? You know, this is the absurdity of it. I'm dealing with this next week. I'm doing a whole series of 9 programs on Police Nation. In any case, I put those up also. But more often than not, in the vast majority, are ones that will inspire us to take a look at the good that's in our lives, what we should be appreciative of each day, to give us hope, and I believe we should always start the day with good news. This is from Ralph Nader. Over 20 years ago, Pat Palmer, in her own words, stumbled upon a $400 overcharge in a bill that her father received on a routine medical procedure. That might have been the costliest overcharge the gouging, overbilling healthcare industry ever inflicted on itself, because it led Pat Palmer, whom Stephen Brill, author of the Time magazine cover story, Why Medical Bills Are Killing Us, called one of my earliest tutors. I tried to figure out the dysfunctional world of medical economics and billing to start a business investigating the overbilling of patients. It's located down in Roanoke, Virginia, Medical Billing Advocates of America, and it makes money by saving patients money. No savings, no charge. In 20 years, she's collected a multitude of cases of doctors, hospitals, and insurance companies overcharging. Now, the evidence reflects routine, everyday overbilling in the, are you ready for this, $270 billion a year. Wow. That's a lot. A fraud. I mean, that's huge. That would make it the largest single example of fraud in the United States, in any area. And here's what Nader says. The systematic fraud goes far beyond the organized criminal syndicates defrauding Medicare that the FBI raids once in a while. The frauds are designed with corporate interest in mind to filch your wallet directly or under the most unobservant insurers, from the very design of billing statements to the manipulation of codes. Start with the fact that about, this is amazing, 80% of all medical bills contain errors, with an average being $1,300. Most of those overbillings favor, unsurprisingly, the sellers, the providers. The situation has been getting worse, with the number of diagnostic codes growing to 60,000 different codes for billing under Obamacare. And that's supposedly to improve efficacy. The system has become even more complicated under Obamacare, with hospitals and few others knowing how to game or beat the system. Now, ways that medical bills are hugely inflated using the technique known as unbundling, when tests and procedures are broken down into their individual components, which allows for double or triple billing. Some hospitals also, by their own admission, incorporate their overhead into the itemized pricing of even simple items, like they'll charge you $20 for a single aspirin. An example of double billing technique is when a patient is charged thousands of dollars a day for being in an intensive care unit, and then is also charged for the ventilator thousands of dollars a day, which is already factored into the cost of the ICU, intensive care unit. Hospitals charge for their mistakes, as in the radiological department. Another example is when they charge you, let's say, $12 each time a nurse brings you an aspirin, even though you're paying for these hospital services in your room rate. Transporting that aspirin is called, are you ready for this? Oral administration fee. So every time you see a nurse walking into a room with a glass of water or anything, it's going to be on your bill. And you can get these itemizations by refusing to accept a summary bill and ask, as is your right under state law, to receive an itemized bill, which sometimes will extend to pages of computer printout in inscrutable code that you can then demand an explanation in ordinary English. Hospital billings for similar services or items vary widely and arbitrarily. A hospital charging $444 for a 10-milligram vial of a neuromuscular blocking drug, Norcuron, one hospital, and another one, it's $17.90 for the same 10-milligram vial. Examples of massive overbilling on major surgeries, medical equipment, and lesser items. People have been charged for phantom procedures never done, physician's visits that you never had, for hospital employees transporting specimens down a few floors to the lab. Patients are charged for ominous services and products, then charged again and again and again. Now, obviously, there are variations as well as in levels of honesty and fraud between institutions and practice, but overall, arguably, our country's biggest commercial crime wave is in medicine. However, strangely, prosecutors reserve their few grand jury indictments largely for the criminal underworld stealing from Medicare or other insurers. For the corporate establishment, there's always the easy ways out, such as confessing error, but not in intent, then caught or arguing reasonably industry practices. They quickly correct the specific bill of its offending bloat and satisfy the complaining patient for nothing charged. Clearly, the current criminal laws do not adequately prevent such computerized theft and need to be amended to account for this fraud. Furthermore, if our nation followed the example of other countries, now here's my point of view, and I'm sure Ralph agrees with this. I believe it's simple. I believe that you eliminate $1 trillion in medical expenses per year. Now, this year we'll spend about $3.3 trillion. This with a T, or three times the national defense budget on medicine. We have some of the worst health care in the world. We absolutely failed in our war on cancer, our war on heart disease, on mental health, on AIDS. We failed miserably in all these. So more wars just mean that more special interest groups, more institutions get more money for failing. But you're never held accountable for failing once you're in that inner golden ring circle. You just get one grant reviewed and then renewed every single year in perpetuity. You have the fraud, which is, as they just showed, to over $270 billion a year. You could eliminate all that. You have defensive medicine where you're given x-rays where you don't need them, CAT scans where you don't need them, and medications that you don't need. That's another $200 to $300 billion a year. You have one-third of all medicine as administration expenses, and under administration, the corporate jets, the salaries and perks and bonuses for the executives of these major companies. And so that's about, let's just make it $700 billion a year. Then you have the excessive pricing based upon the Medicare Act that should be revoked, where a hospital or any of Medicare, Medicaid, they could then turn around and look for the cheapest generic version of that particular drug. Right now they can't. VA can, but no one else can. So if you're told you have to have $300,000 a year treatment for cancer because of the drugs, you have to pay that. So whether it's for-profit or non-for-profit, they both charge outrageous fees. They both make money. What if we just had universal care? took the profit out of medical care and gave the rights of how to treat a patient back to the doctor. If the doctor could not be sued for malpractice, if you had universal, like you do with no-fault auto insurance, you should have no-fault medical insurance. Now, there's a fund set aside so that anyone who is injured can be compensated to a certain amount, and all their expenses to get them recovered is paid for. But we've got to stop the defensive mechanism of saying, every patient I have could be a lawsuit, so I'm going to overdo everything. And that's what it is. Also, quality time for doctors is virtually non-existent in the United States. So if you took the profit out and you brought it back to where the doctor and patient could work cooperatively together and a system was not based upon exploitation, you don't have to have the billing, you don't have to have the bureaucracy, you can eliminate all that and the high cost, then we would start to have better health care. And everybody would be included. Nobody would be filing for bankruptcy because of medical bills. That is what an enlightened nation does. Next up, we're retiring in droves. This is from Psychology Today, Dr. John Nofsinger. It's an article entitled, Can New Public Debt Really Support Our Social Insurance Programs? It's short, but it's important we understand this. I'll quote him. The baby boomers are retiring and signing up for Social Security, Medicare, and supplemental medical insurance benefits. I recently read that 10,000 people are retiring per day. That's every day, 10,000. That's 3 million people in America retiring per year. Our social insurance taxes stopped covering the cost of the benefits about 5 years ago. So now there is a deficit that will grow very large. There's a debate that seems concerned with how long the trust fund will last before it's depleted. However, I think that an entire discussion misses the real issues. Unless new taxes are levied, that deficit will have to be funded with new issues of debt to the public. Consider the Social Security Administration needing to cover a deficit to pay benefits. And by the way, for those of you who say that Social Security is flush with money, yes and no. What has happened is at any time during almost all previous administrations, when they needed money, they would give an IOU to the Social Security Administration. And as if they were going to pay back, the trouble is they haven't paid it back. So on the one hand, they have taken trillions of dollars from the Social Security fund. So if all the money that had been borrowed was put back, then it would be fine. But it hasn't been. Now, they hand over their special issue treasury bonds to the U.S. Treasury for cash. Of course, since the U.S. government runs a budget deficit, the Treasury doesn't have any cash at all. So they issue new bonds to the public. So the debt that is held within the government, called the interagency debt, is converted to public debt and starts to impact the debt markets and interest rates. And what are the size of this new debt? Well, I began by obtaining the predicted general revenue shortfalls for Social Security, Medicare, and Supplemental Medicaid, Medicare, from the Social Security Administration. They come in percent of GDP, gross domestic product. So I take last year, it was 16.7 trillion, and grow that in the future by 2% real growth rate, combining the shortfalls and the gross domestic product estimates results is simple. It's about $242 billion per year to $300 billion per year that we need just for these shortfalls. Quote from the piece, I'm 48 years old, so my retirement is at age 67 is about 20 years from now. In that 20 years, the Treasury will need to issue a cumulative $12.9 trillion to fund the social insurance deficit. As comparison, the total public debt outstanding as of July 2014 is $12.7 trillion. Wow, the public debt will double in just 20 years. So, how would I go about dealing with this? It's simple. Never confuse the complexity of a problem with simplicity of an answer. If we really wanted to pay down the national debt and eliminate the Federal Reserve and have the Treasury, as it historically did, print money and go back to a gold standard, then what we would do and give value back to the dollar and stop all quantitative easing, which does not benefit any of us, then you would put a small tax on every single transaction, every one of the algorithms, transactions on Wall Street, and you would put a 2% tax on that. That would bring in $1 trillion a year. And therefore, you give that specifically to Medicare and Social Security Fund to repay the debt and get it flush with cash. Also, then you tax everything that's an exotic, meaning something that does not contribute to the well-being financially of our society, like derivatives, credit default swaps. And you charge a 5% tax on that. Worldwide, there's over $600 trillion, more than all the money in the world times six. And that's how they play this casino capitalism. We'll charge them a tax on it. Then let's see how quick they are to get into that game. We should ban all derivative trading, all of it. We should ban all trading in any commodity that's essential to life. That means you cannot trade in the market on oil, gas, water, and food. That would bring the cost of all those down and make food plentiful. We just have too much profit for too few people and everyone else paying for it. So that's how you pay for the shortfalls. Tax the people. Tax the Uber 1%. That's where you get your money back. And it's legitimate to tax them on that. I'm Gary Noll, broadcasting all over the world. I want to thank you. I was just told that we have, in the last 5 days, 2.5 million people viewing daily. That's every day. Every day. Now, I was just corrected here. Every day, we have 2.5 million people reading our content. So thank you for that. Those are some huge numbers, huge. And we thank you, and we will continue to give you information that is inspirational, empowering, and that can give you the tools you need. And we're going to start today by re-airing Autism Made in USA with a new article that includes some stuff from The Whistleblower, so you can re-familiarize yourself with what we were showing in the film, Autism Made in USA. And behind that is Silent Epidemic, where I interviewed all these leading immunologists and virologists and individuals who are experts in the field of vaccine. And I asked them, are vaccines safe and effective? And they said, no. These are not holistic anything. These are not complementary doctors. These are orthodox scientists and physicians telling us, no, the proof is not there. This is the latest. This is from Dr. Andrew Wakefield's, and we can thank Vaccine Liberation Army for sending this over to me. Quote, this is from Dr. William Thompson, the CDC whistleblower, to Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Dr. Wakefield, I apologize again for the price you paid for my dishonesty. Wakefield, is the press release real? Thompson, yes. Wakefield, thank you. It was the right and honorable thing to do. Thompson, I agree. I apologize for the price you paid for my dishonesty. Wakefield, I forgive you completely and without any bitterness. Thompson, I know you mean it, and I'm grateful to know you you more personally, end quote. Now, the last desperate effort when the CDC whistleblower story broke last week was for the vaccine establishment and the media to drive a wedge between Dr. Thompson Wakefield, whose so-called fraud, according to British journalist Brian Deer, has been made to carry the sins of the entire vaccine industry for many years. Dr. Wakefield shared two text messages with the truth barrier that he and his wife received from Dr. Thompson. And the first one was to Dr. Wakefield's wife. Carmel, and it read, quote, I do believe your husband's career was unjustly damaged, and this study would have supported his scientific opinion. Hopefully I can help repair it. That's from Dr. William Thompson. That was August 27, 2014. Polly Tommy, director of Autism Media Channel, told the Truth Barrier, there are more whistleblowers trying to find the courage and the legal protection to speak. Quote, this is from Polly Tommy. There are more whistleblowers coming out. We know who they are, and we've spoken to them. They're petrified. These sources make Thompson pale in comparison on some of them. They know the MMR vaccine is a massive problem. Data has been corrupted. They've been told to hide things. End quote. So, and one of them made this quote, quote, you can forget about the MMR vaccine. Gardasil is one of the biggest crimes ever. 144 girls or something have died already. Thompson is only the beginning. Okay. Well, we will continue to bring this information to you and look forward to seeing these whistleblowers. I have a team of lawyers meeting me right after the program today to see about bringing class action lawsuits against the government, because you see, you're indemnified if you're a government employee, but not if you commit a crime with knowledge that it is a crime you're committing. Then you're in a different position legally. So some of the best attorneys in America are meeting, and we're going to also work with the whistleblower attorneys, but this is a big story. The media is not touching it at all, and we understand why, because we know who controls them. Now, to a separate issue, this is from The Guardian, from Arjun Sethi. The U.S. government can brand you a terrorist based upon a Facebook post. We can't let them make up the rules. Quote, innocent people's lives are being ruined. Why isn't anyone watching the watch list? The U.S. government's web of surveillance is vast and interconnected. Now we know just how opaque, inefficient, and discriminatory it can be. As we were reminded again this week, you can be pulled into the National Security Agency's database quietly and quickly, and the consequences can be long and enduring. Through their IC Reach, a Google-style search engine created for the Intelligence Committee, the National Security Agency provides data on private communications to 23 government agencies. More than 1,000 analysts had access to that information. This kind of data sharing, however, isn't limited to the latest from Edward Snowden's National Security Agency files. It was confirmed earlier this month that the FBI shares its master watch list, the terrorist screening database, with at least 22 foreign governments, countless federal agencies, state and local law enforcement, plus private contractors. The watch list tracks known and suspected terrorists and includes both foreigners and Americans. It is based on very loose standards and secret evidence, which ensures that they can ensnare innocent people. Indeed, the standards are so low that the U.S. government's guidelines specifically allow for a single, uncorroborated source of information, including a Facebook or Twitter post, to serve as the basis for placing you on its master watch list. Of the 680,000 individuals on that FBI master list, roughly 40% have, quote, no recognized terrorist group affiliation, according to The Intercept. These individuals don't even have a connection, as the government loosely defines it, to a designated terrorist group, but they're still branded as suspected terrorists. The absurdities don't end there. Take Dearborn, Michigan, a city with a population of under 100,000 that is known for its large Arab American community and has been more watch list residents than any other city in America except New York. These eye-popping numbers are largely the result of the U.S. government's use of loose standards, so-called reasonable suspicion, in determining who exactly can be watch listed. Reasonable suspicion is such a low standard because it requires neither concrete evidence nor irrefutable evidence. Instead, an official is permitted to consider reasonable inference to draw from the fact in lights of that experience. Consider a real-world context, actual criminal justice, where an officer needs reasonable suspicion to stop a person in the street and ask him a question. Courts have controversially held that avoiding eye contact with an officer traveling alone, traveling late at night, for example, all amount to reasonable suspicion. So this vague criteria is now being used to label innocent people as terrorist suspects. Moreover, because the watch list isn't limited to known actual terrorists, an official can watch list a person if he has reasonable suspicion to believe that that person is a suspected terrorist. It's a circular logic. Individuals can be watchlisted if they are suspected of being suspected terrorists. That is ultimately backwards and must be changed. Time for you to call in and share your thoughts on our talkback segment, 888-874-4888. I'd like to hear from you on any of the issues that we discuss that you think are important. Let's say hello to James from Queens. Hi, James. Your turn.
Oh, good afternoon, Gary. You know, you mentioned something so important about the baby boomers. Going back to those that were born during the 40s up to now that are able to live that long. And there was a time when you worked, and after you reached a certain 65, you didn't have to work anymore. That was it. Now they've changed the rules of the Social Security to the point that you can work till you almost drop to your feet. And the issue is that whatever money that was put into the Social Security, as you mentioned, is no longer there. So they raised the age up to almost 75 in order to get Social Security. And I was wondering, since this economy is in such a bad condition, a lot of people are not working and not paying into the system. Can you clear that up?
Yes, you are. Well, it's not only are fewer people paying in, there are fewer jobs. But remember, Social Security is not an entitlement. On the right, you and corporate Democrats, you hear them talking about, you know, privatize Social Security because it is an entitlement. It is not. The government doesn't pay my Social Security. I pay it. You pay it. We pay it throughout our lifetimes. It comes out of every one of our checks. And our employers pay it. So it's not an entitlement. That's number one. Number two, the government has been borrowing from Ronald Reagan on hundreds of billions of dollars to pay other debt and putting an IOU in there. And why isn't that when there's any discussion, they never talk about what are the repayment obligations with interest to those agencies or parts of government that have borrowed that money? They never use that figure, so they're never honest. It's like saying, oh, we have 6% unemployment. Are you counting all the people that are working two jobs? Are you counting the people that are underemployed? Are you counting the people who stopped working because they couldn't find age discrimination? Are you counting all the 1 million homeless vets who can't get a job because nobody wants to hire a homeless vet? No. Well, then if you accounted everyone who's able to work, who's not able to find a job, you're at 24%. We just are never honest about anything in our society. So I believe that what we should do is we should have independent people, first and foremost, tell the American people exactly what is the debt against the Social Security, how much do we have, and what is needed in this shortfall. Because you have another phenomena, James. You have those people you said at 65 historically could retire and do whatever they chose after that. But most of those people retiring had a gainful employment, and that was between the 1940s and the 1970s when they had the highest standard of living among the working class in America's history. And that's because we had strong unions. We had strong representation. We had standards. We had accountability of corporate interest at the national and local level. All that's gone now. Outsourcing of over 30 million American jobs, or downsizing 30 million American jobs, the closing of 58,000 factories in the last 12 years. So all the politicians on both sides have been a part of this, but it's been this kind of, let's not make this an issue, because if you make an issue, it'll concern people. But on the other end of that, we are not reindustrializing America. We're not even supporting small business. If you want to turn our whole economy around, James, all you had to do is this. Offer the same amount of money on a monthly basis that we give to the big banks, anywhere between $89 to $104 billion interest-free. Offer that to qualified small business people in every community, and only have a small committee of five of the long-established small businesses, must be a small business in each community, who could then look to see the quality of that new business in their community or growing small businesses. And you give them upwards of $5 million maximum, but for each $1 million, they must hire 2 employees at a living wage, meaning at least $20 an hour with health care. Do you realize that more Americans work for small businesses than any other group in the United States, more than the federal government, more than the Fortune 500 companies? We would then be able to provide a quality of care to the community. You'd bring dollars and jobs back to the local community, and you would de-ghettoize the community. Imagine in every community if you could rehabilitate it using interest-free money and giving gainful employment locally. So you wouldn't be buying other companies, you wouldn't be engaged in monopolizing, you wouldn't be using debt as an asset. Instead, you would be using the government money as equity into the community. You would be able to employ at least 5 to 10 million Americans within 2 to 3 years at a living wage. That's how we should be using our money. We're not doing that. We won't do that because that doesn't help those who are in control of our economy. They want all of it for themselves. So thank you for your call, James. I appreciate it. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day, everyone. Now let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're going to be talking about the Detroit bankruptcy trial. All sides are telling it to the judge. And we'll be talking about the Justice Department announcing that it will conduct an investigation into the police department at Ferguson, but it's still on a civil rights issue.
There's also something else here I hope at some point you discuss, and that is, if we wanted to stop the overreach of local police, then we would reevaluate their training. We would take away their armor. We would take away all of the militarization equipment they've received, call it all back, and start a whole new program and have community outreach leaders in every police department. I put a post up today on my website of a young 8-year-old boy in handcuffs slammed up on a police headquarters cruiser because he was acting out in school, but he has autism. Now, when you and I were going to school, they had counselors in school. So if there was a kid that was acting out in any way, the counselor was the first person to intervene with him after the teacher. Instead, today, teachers immediately call the police. The police come, and there is zero tolerance. It doesn't matter what age you are. They'll put you in handcuffs. They'll beat you up. They'll knock the hell out of you. And they know that they'll be protected because they'll say, no matter how many of them are, that they were in fear of their life. And we've seen this argument. Even when they broke into the room of a 96-year-old man laying in bed who didn't want to go to the hospital because he had intestinal problems, so their decision was to shoot him in the chest with a 12-gauge shotgun and kill him. They did that. 5 fully armed police officers shot a man in Chicago, killed him, 96 years of age, and of course their union came to their defense and they said they felt threatened. And you think, why doesn't the Attorney General and the President of the United States intervene? By executive order. He could do it, and the Attorney General could say, stop it, and say, anyone else overreaching on these issues, we will investigate you and you will be prosecuted. Now, if they threaten to prosecute every police officer that used excessive force in killing people, arresting people, and if the President of the United States pulled back all that armament and started putting counselors back in the schools, you'd have a different and communities. And first, if you had a problem, you go to your local non-lethal, non-threatening, non-lasered, non-beat-the-hell-out-of-the-person counselor and let the counselors intervene first. And we don't have any of that right now in the United States. That's unfortunate. Hope you deal with that at some point.
Well, do. We'll think about it. But, you know, part of the thing is, first you have to have schools.
Yeah. You're right.
This president has been shutting them down more than anybody else.
Well, there's a reason. And you know and I know it's profit for Bill Gates and the people who want to privatize through the charters.
That's exactly it.
And remember, charters don't charge kids, but they charge the state, and it's very profitable. So we'll come back with you in just 60 seconds. Utrice Lead right now.